We find ourselves in Exodus 21. It says this, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them." When we speak here about judgments, that's an important word because what we're going to be talking about is the judges. This is basically the legislative information that the rulers or the judges of Israel are going to need for righteousness. Where we find ourselves is that Moses has gone up to the mountain. God has given him the Ten Commandments. And now for the next three chapters, Moses is going to hear from the Lord directly more details about that. And these are for the judges. Matter of fact, if you look at verse 6, you'll find that it says, "Then his master shall bring him to the judges." And so this is all for the judges. Interesting thing about that, the word there, judges, is the word in Hebrew, Elohim, which is the word for God. In the beginning, God created. Bereshit bara Elohim. Elohim is a plural word. It actually is translated God in the context. We don't have an English equivalent, but it's really the plural form of the word God. And when God takes that name, it's used sort of in a poetic sense of his massive, overwhelming might as God. But here is the same word. There was a time when Jesus was challenged in John chapter 10 for making himself to be equal with God. And Jesus responded to those Pharisees. He says, "Doesn't the scripture itself say that you are gods?" And what Jesus was doing was quoting a psalm to them to indicate that they were Elohim. They were judges. And what he was actually doing was he was turning around what they were saying and he was telling them, "Why don't you judge for yourself what I do and what I say and see for yourself? You're supposed to be judges." Now somebody's going to inevitably take that scripture and say, "Well, doesn't it say that we are gods?" And of course they pull the scripture out of context and they misuse it. But here we're speaking about the authority that a judge has, because we're going to be talking about life and death. How would you like to have the role of sentencing somebody to a death sentence? And God will give them that authority. And so these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant or slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. Now, these are not slaves that were taken slaves, but the way that you would go into slavery in those days is through extreme poverty, first of all. If you got in such great debt that you had to actually sell yourself as a servant, you could become a slave. Secondly, if you were sold, your family could sell you to be a slave. I've got four daughters, and in that culture, they could sell their daughters off to gain wealth. I don't agree with it. It's not right. But that was done quite often in those times. Another way is that you could be in debt. You could actually go bankrupt. And you had borrowed money, and you couldn't pay it back, so you would actually go into service. Or if you were a thief, the sentence for thieves was oftentimes to become sort of an indentured servant, a slave to somebody. And so, but God here says that if you buy a servant, they serve 6 years, and the seventh year free. It kind of indicates to us that God does not like debt. God does not like us to be in debt. He doesn't want us to owe. He doesn't want any servant or slavery to be lifelong. A while back, my wife and I were in debt. It just had happened that way because of their certain financial situations. And through prayer and faithfulness and giving and just doing the right thing, God brought us out of that debt. And I remember the day when we were out of debt. It was a day of rejoicing because nobody likes to have that thing hanging over them. And I think that God here, he just kind of indicates that slavery may be something that has to be part of life for a time being, but there's a limit. 6 years, and that's it. It's over. And if you're in debt right now, you might be feeling like a slave to your credit card or a slave to your mortgage or your car payments. And yet, you know what? I think that the Lord in time will help you out of that because that's his heart. He doesn't want you to be bound to something. Now, we read in verse 3, if he comes in by himself, he'll go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. But if his master has given him a wife, and she's borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. So that's kind of tough. If the master gives a wife to that man while he's in slavery, she still belongs to the master. So if you start a family in slavery or in servitude, then you leave that family when you leave. However, if the servant plainly says, "I love my master, my wife, my children, I will not go out free," then the master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost. and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl. An awl is sort of like a hole punch or a dowel. They would pierce their ear, and he shall serve him forever. And this is what would be called bond slavery. You would become a bond slave. And that's what the term that the New Testament uses. Paul uses of himself, I am a bond slave of Christ. You can imagine there, you see a guy walking along, oh, what a bummer. That poor guy, he's a slave. Look at him, he's dragging the burden for that master. And then he comes a little closer. Hey, wait a second, there's something in his ear. A big ring is hanging out of his ear. Your whole perspective changes on him. You're no longer saying, oh, poor guy. You're saying, oh, I guess he's got a good master. It's a real indication that he's got a good master. And so, Christians, you ought to be considering yourselves to be a bond servant. I'm a bond slave of Jesus Christ. I should serve him. I owe him. But there comes a time in every person's life when they realize that the Lord just says, you don't have to serve me. You don't have to do it. You're free to go. And at that point, when you just say, you know what? I love my master. I love what he does for me. I look at my life while I serve him, and I look at my life not serving him, and I think I'd rather be a bond slave. I just love serving God. And anybody who knows the Lord knows what a good master he is and how great it is to serve him. And so we read on now about verse 7. It says, if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. Now this is really talking about betrothal. In those days, marriages would be arranged. Daughters would be arranged with another man or another man's son. And so we read in verse 8, if she does not please her master who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people since he has dealt deceitfully with her. So you can't set up a bride for sale business. You know, you make deals with guys in the community. Oh, maybe I'll have my son marry your daughter. And he brings him in, and she's 15 years old, and they're ready to get the wedding done, but then he sells her off to a foreign people. God says none of that. And what God is doing here, it's amazing, because in that culture, this was very common. And God is now instilling in these people rights for slaves. And you have to put yourself in that culture. This never existed. I mean, this is so revolutionary that God is now, through his law, inserting into their culture value for human rights and dignity. It's amazing what he's doing. And he's instilling in people value for others who were, in that culture, just seen as property. Slaves could be beaten and killed. And nobody would think anything about it. But the culture was going to change now that God's law entered in. Now it says in verse 9, if he has betrothed her to his son, well, he'll deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes another wife instead of her, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. And so if this man doesn't marry her and he chooses another woman, well, he still needs to provide for her, and the Lord provides for her rights in that way. If he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. She'll be a free woman. Verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. And so here, anybody who ever tells you that God is against capital punishment is simply ignorant of the word of God. Right here, Exodus 21, verse 12. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. This is, well, two things God is doing here. Number one, it's a deterrence. You have to think twice now if there is a threat on your life. If you are in a fight and you pick up a baseball bat or you pick up a crowbar, you better watch out. You cannot unleash the full vengeance that you might feel because there is a severe penalty. If you strike a person so that they die, your life will be on the line now. So first of all, deterrence. And secondly, God's indicating the value that he places on life. Now, God initially gave the power of government to mankind after the flood. Remember when Noah got off the ark and God spoke to Noah and said, if a man sheds another man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. So he sets up an institution of government to keep law and order in the world. It was very rudimentary at the time. It basically said, you guys have to control yourselves through an institution. Corporately, where people get together and they stop others from killing. We read about the world before the flood. It was filled with violence. It was just might made right. Everybody was killing and destroying, and nobody could stop anybody because there was no organized strength. And so God would give the power of government into the hand of man, and he would do it in order to execute justice. However, now God makes a differentiation between premeditated and manslaughter. Premeditated murder is if somebody intended to kill, but manslaughter is an accident. Verse 13, however, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to flee. We're going to read about in Numbers chapter 35 and Joshua chapter 20 about these cities of refuge. It was an accident. You know, in those days, the example is given over in Numbers, I believe, where two men are chopping down trees in the woods, and the axe handle comes off, and he swings, and that thing flies off and through the air, and it hits the other guy on the head, you know, he's dead. And his family now has the ability to come after you. There weren't any police officers in those days to arrest. There weren't any executioners in those days. It was the family's job to mete out the justice on that person, to get judgment. And so that family would come after you. But it was an accident, you know, but they're still coming with stones in their hands. And then you're dead. So you could run to these six cities that were called cities of refuge. It's interesting, in Hawaiian culture, they have cities of refuge. And basically what that allows for was people to run there until a trial was set where the judges would get around and he would say, look, I have nothing against this guy. I have no motive. I have no reason to hurt him. He was my friend. I didn't want to do that. And the judges would then protect you and you would stay in that city. You would be safe in that city from the avenger. And so God sets these up, and we'll read about them later. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar, even if he's holding onto the altar. Mercy, I want mercy, that he may die. And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Probably understood along with verse 12, in the sense, you know, he who strikes a man so that he dies. It's attempted murder. I bet they didn't have any problems with their teenagers back then. It's not for kids. It's not for babies. And no parent would ever want to do that for their kids. You can read over in Deuteronomy chapter 21 where the parents, if they come to the judges and say, our son is a glutton and a drunkard, and then they would take him and they would stone him outside the city. Swift justice. Now, as I read this, I realize, well, sometimes I can be offended by this, or other people can be offended. But the reason that we're offended is because we live in America. And our perception of justice just might be off. Let's consider that for a moment. We just might be way off. And here God says, this is the way I want it. This is what is to be done. And so, as we read along, we read here in verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. You can also understand this as maybe a threat from an adult child, a curse, you know, bringing a curse upon them, or cursing them and embarrassing them in public. If men contend with each other, verse 18, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, but he does not die, but he's confined to his bed. If he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time, and he shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. So sort of a worker's comp kind of a thing, a payment for him to be healed. If he misses his harvest because he can't walk, you know, well, I really beat him up. I broke his leg. Well, he can't walk. Now you're going to have to plow his field. Now you're going to have to do the work. See, what God's teaching these people is personal responsibility. You can't just fly off the handle and do anything you want. There are consequences. Now this is important because these were a bunch of slaves. All they knew was the crack of the whip. All they knew was driving slaves. And here God is giving them some boundaries. And so he says, in verse 20, if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. This was, again, revolutionary in those days because slaves were considered to be property. They were like this chair. I can smash a chair. Nobody would say anything about it, but now God stands up for those servants. Notwithstanding, verse 21, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. The idea here is that a man who beats his slave knows how to kill him. He knows how to beat him to death. And the idea is, if he didn't mean to kill him, well, he wouldn't die right away. You know, it wasn't premeditated murder. It was just a beating. And an infection sets in and death incurs, but it wasn't that he was trying to kill him by beating. So he loses just simply because he loses his property. He loses the value of his servant plowing his fields or tending his oxen. Verse 22, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, but no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according to the woman's, as the woman husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So now the judges are going to come into play here. Two men are fighting, and incidentally, maybe one of the men's wife comes in, and she's pregnant, and you know, somebody hits her, and she goes into labor. She has a child right there. No harm. So the baby's born. Everything's fine. Then, good. No harm, no foul. The woman's husband can impose on him some kind of penalty, but not heavy. But, verse 23, if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life. Now God is even protecting the unborn. But if any harm follows, life for life, and this is for the judges, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. What God is telling the judges is, look, it is equity. It is compensation, not retribution. Our tendency is, you know, you're driving along, somebody cuts you off. The tendency is to pull in front of them and slam on your brakes. Well, maybe it's not for you, but it is for me sometimes. I fight that tendency. See, the idea is always, you know, somebody hits you, you hit them back, but you hit them worse, right? And what God is saying is if there is a problem, you judges need to mete out equity. It is not for retribution, it is for compensation. You don't want to have disproportionate lawsuit damages like you see nowadays. I spilled coffee on me. I need $30 million. You know, that's not justice. That is ridiculous. And it doesn't go toward personal responsibility. It's not equity. And so the judges are told, look, mete out justice, and that's equity. Verse 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male servant or female servant and destroys it, well, he'll let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he will let him go free for the sake of his tooth. And so that beating we were talking about earlier, that master is going to pay for all of this. Now, God can't necessarily, you know, the law can't change a person's heart. You know, the speed limit can say something, but it can't make me want to go that speed. It just tells me what is right to do. And here what God is doing is, even if you don't show humanity, or even if you don't want to treat your servants humanely, you must treat them at least with caution. And so God provides a level of dignity for the servants that never existed beforehand. You know, you got to think twice. You want to punch that servant and his tooth comes out? Well, you're going to come to the judges. We're going to take a little ball-peen hammer and pop your tooth right out. You're going to be very careful, aren't you? You're going to be cautious. You're going to guard yourself. You're going to hold yourself with dignity and control yourself, which is what God is sowing into these people. Notice in verse 28 now, he's talking about property. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past and has been made known to its owner, and he has not kept it confined so that it has killed a man or a woman, now the ox will be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. Well, that's heavy, isn't it? This is gross negligence. When I read a verse like this, I think of repeat offenders when it comes to drunk driving. Drunk drivers who kill people knowing that they have a tendency to do this in the past. Now, a man owns an ox, it gets out, and it just destroys a child. You know, sometimes pit bulls, they do that, you know, and this dog gets out, and the owner says, oh, I didn't know, this is terrible, it's a tragedy, and it is. That's not negligence, that's just ignorance. We didn't know that this animal had the capability of doing that. But if that dog does that again, and you've allowed him to do that, that's negligence, and you should pay for that. There's a differentiation of neglect and intent. So God wants to make sure that people take responsibility for their animals. Now, it should be a death penalty, but if you could work out a deal, verse 30 says, but if there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on him. He doesn't have to die, but he can buy his way out of that, make a settlement with the family of the person that was lost. Verse 31, whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a male or female servant, it shall give the master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Interesting, the price of a dead servant was 30 pieces of silver, the amount that was paid for Jesus, who was the servant of God who was slain for us. But notice also in verse 31, whether it was a son or daughter, a female or male servant, they all had the same rights. They all had the same rights. Now, in a culture like that, and in the ancient world, women did not have any rights whatsoever. And they still wouldn't to a large extent until Jesus really brought them up to the level that they deserve and rightfully should have. But here God in his law says there is equal protection under the law for both male and female. Whether rich or poor, whether they're a servant or whether they're wealthy, they have the same rights. If a man opens a pit, verse 33, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or donkey falls into it, then the owner of the pit shall make it good. I like the way it says that. Make it good. Just do the right thing. You should have covered that up. It was negligent that you didn't put warning signs around it. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his. So it's kind of a you broke it, you bought it kind of thing. You messed up, well, this dead animal's yours, and you're going to give him your live animal. Verse 35, if one man's ox hurts another so that he dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox they shall divide also. Or if it was known that the ox tended to thrust or gore in times past, and its owner has not kept it confined, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his own. So if he kills an animal knowing that this was a wild and aggressive animal, then he shall pay. The thing about justice as we go through here is it's amazing that God is really showing them the difference between errors and accidents, incidental things. They would be not punished, but sort of restored with equity and restitution. Now for malicious things, for deceptive crimes, for theft, there would be punitive damages assessed on the person. It would be a penalty. Now in our society, we don't have, you know, we used to have penal colonies. There used to be penitentiaries. But now, they're not even that, are they? They're correctional facilities. But we don't mete out punishment for wrong behavior. Actually, I just read in the paper that we have this massive prison crisis in the United States of America. Prisons are just overcrowded because, well, people for petty crimes are serving time when God would say that if you steal something, you just have to pay it back. Now, in our world, they, you know, the idea is, well, you pay back society in general. Have anybody ever had their car stolen? I've had my car stolen. It is just so frustrating. And I got my car back. But under God's law, the person that was caught would give me an additional car extra. And that's what we'll read about here, is they would actually pay back the person they wronged twice. Oh, have you ever had your car broken into? Oh, man, that just, you feel robbed because you are robbed. I mean, you feel like you have been violated. Well, God would deal with that in chapter 22. If a man steals an ox or sheep and he slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. No jail. No jail time. We don't read anything about prison sentences here. The prisons would actually be men who owned, or people who owned, men or women who owned things would actually buy people and pay money in order to have them slaves for 6 years. And so if a man stole an ox, he couldn't pay 5 oxes back and oxen back. He would have to become a servant and pay that back. That'd be nice. You stole my tractor. I'm getting 6 tractors back, you know, mine and 5 others. That's because he took it to the chop shop, you know, the slaughterhouse, and he tried to cover his crime. Now, if they caught it with the ox on him, as we'll see, he'll restore double. And now we read about this. Remember David when he was confronted by the prophet and Nathan told him about the rich man who had all kinds of cattle and flocks and somebody was visiting him and he went over to his neighbor's house who had just a little lamb. And they had it as a pet, and this rich man stole the lamb, and he slaughtered it and gave a feast for his friend that was visiting. And David, in his righteous hypocrisy, said, that man shall surely die and restore 4-fold. See, because he knew the law, but he was guilty of doing the very same thing. And the prophet's long bony finger said, thou art the man. You did it. And David was broken there, but he knew the law. And he was very quick to condemnation until it was his own sin. Now we notice here in verse 2, if the thief is found breaking in and he's struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. Somebody's breaking into your house, it's dark, you grab the bat that's by the door or the umbrella, you poke his eye out, and the man dies. Did you hear about this kid the other day? This was he 12 years old? The mom was screaming in the kitchen. They ran like a bed and breakfast. One of the men that lived there kind of went crazy. And he was choking her on the kitchen floor. And this kid, I think he was 8 or 12 years old, he came in and he was yelling, stop it, stop it. And this man just kept choking her. And he grabbed a kitchen knife and he just blindly slashed. And he cut the man's neck and the man died. And, you know, the big question is, well, what do we do? boy, what a traumatic thing for this young boy. Traumatic, but heroic. In one sense, it's a tragedy that this man died, but the kid did all he could do to protect his mom. This man was going to kill his mom. And, how traumatic is that for an eight-year-old to do that? I mean, my kid is 8 years old. I couldn't imagine that. And yet God says, if it's dark and they're breaking in, and you don't know if they're going to do you physical harm, you don't know what they're there to steal, you don't know who it is, if they're killed in the process, you're free. You're free and clear. You were defending yourself. You can use deadly force in self-defense. But notice in verse 3, if the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. In other words, if the thief is breaking in and you come, hey, what are you doing? And he's going to take off. Now, if he turns on you, then you still have the right to defend yourself, even using deadly force. But you don't have the right to use deadly force in protecting property. That's the issue. If they're just simply stealing property, you can catch them, but you can't use deadly force to stop them for property's sake. Now, if it's in self-defense, it's a different story. Now, if the thief is found alive, whether it has an ox or donkey or sheep, he shall restore double. So he stole the stuff, he still has it. Well, he has to pay it back and double it. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. Now, you imagine you have a flock, you just take it over to your buddy's yard. And you know, it's like walking your dog and let him do his thing on his yard and then bringing it home. You know, well, he can deal with that big pile on his yard. Don't do that. God says, come on. It's not. People do that. I mean, you'd think, oh, Israel, aren't they just a bunch of loving people? They would never do that. Yes, they would do that. And God says, if you get caught doing that, that guy can come over and take the best of what he wants. So don't do it. We go on and it says, if a fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that the stacked grain, standing grain, for example, or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution, personal responsibility. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it's stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double, just as it said earlier. But if the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether he has put his hand into the neighbor's goods. Now, in those days, they didn't have banks, so somebody would have like a safe house, and you could bring your gold or your precious items, and he would keep it for that person. But if it got stolen, the question would be, you know, did it really get stolen, or did you sell that to your buddy that was taking a caravan down to Arabia and he's going to sell that off? And so he'd be brought to the judges and he would have to take an oath. And so it says, and we read about that in the following verses, for any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox, a donkey, sheep, clothing, or any kind of lost thing, which another claims to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. And whomever the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, sheep, or any animal to keep, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away, no one seeing it, then an oath of the Lord shall be between them both that he has not put his hand into the neighbor's goods. And the owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. So the man swears before the Lord, puts his hand on a Tanakh, an Old Testament, says, I swear that I did not steal this stuff, and it wasn't my fault. The band of Philistines came in and took everything. I did everything I could. Then the owner, he's just got to accept that. He's telling the truth before the Lord, and that's got to be good enough. Now, in verse 14, it says, if a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it, not being with it, he shall surely make it good. So you borrow a lawnmower from your neighbor, blade breaks, you buy him a new one. That broken lawnmower is now yours. You just bought it. It'd make you think twice about borrowing a wrench or anything like that. You know, don't lose that hammer that you borrowed. Don't break that pair of pliers that you borrowed. So if it breaks while you're using it, then you replace it. However, if the owner was with it, he shall not make it good. If it was hired, it came for its hire. So if the owner was driving, you know, hey, I'm going to pay you to plow my fields. He says, do you just want to rent the ox, or do you want me to plow it for you? I'll just rent the ox. You're driving the ox, the thing keels over right there. Hey, what's going on? That's your ox now. But if you say, hey, why don't you plow my field, and I'll pay you for it, and the owner is driving it, you know, you can't say, well, you drove it too hard. Well, it's your ox. You drove it, and it died, and I paid you to do the thing. So God makes it very clear. And in verse 16, we read on, if a man entices a virgin, now this has been going on for thousands of years. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and he lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. So this speaks of value, God's value of purity. They would pay the bride price. Notice it says there, if a man entices a virgin, he will pay the bride price. That's a dowry. In those days, they would pay a dowry. A dowry would convey a few things. It would convey a man's respect for the woman's father. It wouldn't necessarily be the amount of money that he was offering. It would be the percentage of his wealth. He might not be a very wealthy man, but what he brings, that father would understand that to be respect. The other thing it would indicate would be the love that this guy has for the woman and the value that he places on her. And thirdly, it would be basically alimony in advance. If that man died and that woman had no livelihood, then she could go back to her father's house where there would be an additional amount of wealth so that her father could continue to raise her and sort of take care of her. Now, this was the case. So what this would do would say there is no casual sex. If you want to do that, you have got to be willing to pay. And in those days, it was not $20. It wasn't $50. It wasn't $200. It was about $10,000, $20,000, a year's wage. You would give a huge amount of money. Now, our culture is totally different. We just totally have lost the value for intimacy and purity in that sense. Now, what if the father says, no way, buddy, you're a scumbag, I don't like you. Well, that's verse 17. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. So he has to pay anyway. And the father would refuse the marriage. I heard a story about a woman who was selling a table at her garage sale. It was worth $600, but she had marked it down to $300. And some guy came in and he wanted to bargain her down to $200. In the bargaining process, she realized that it was actually worth $600. And so in the end, she argued him back up to $600, and he paid $600 because that was what it was really worth. And he treated it like a $600 table. But it indicates sort of a truth that sometimes people can be mistreated, and it happens all too often. Some women are treated badly because they cheapen themselves and they sell out way too early at far too low a price. And then later on in their marriage or in their relationship, they wonder, why does he treat me so bad? Well, you sold out for $200 when you were worth far more than that. You sold out for a low price and you didn't realize that you were worth so much more. Make sure that you remember that when you speak to younger people today. Verse 18, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Zero tolerance for witchcraft. Boy, how our culture has moved. Has witchcraft has just exploded in our world today? I understand the U.S. military pays chaplains, but they also pay Wiccan priests to run services. Our government, your tax dollars actually support witchcraft. But God says zero tolerance for it. Go to Borders this week and say, hey, I want to look for a book on witchcraft. Oh, it's right here, giant section. You just want fiction? Harry Potter. I saw this article, top 20 young stars that have made it to the top. And about half of them have all made all their money in the Harry Potter films. And we don't make a big thing. We don't make these social things. Don't see Harry Potter. But think about the glorification of witchcraft. I'm real careful with my kids because I know that the world wants to glorify this, but God says absolutely no tolerance. No tolerance for this stuff. Why? Because the spiritual world is real. The demonic realm is real. There is warfare going on. There is an attack on our souls from the spiritual realm that we need to be aware of. It is no laughing matter. It's no joke. The Bible tells us that we wage war not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, forces, powers, in high places, darkness. So we don't toy with this. We don't play with this. Verse 19, whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. Bestiality is condemned. The Bible covers everything. There was a film at the Sundance Film Festival last year. It was about bestiality. It was called Zoo. The director said, "I've asbesticized the sleaze right out of it. He's made it such a beautiful picture," they said. It won awards, and oh, how popular it was. We don't even need to say any more about that. God says it's an abomination. "He who sacrifices to any god except the Lord, he shall be utterly destroyed. You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way, and they cry out at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives will be widows, and your children fatherless." So God is very serious about defending the defenseless, and he doesn't want a society that preys on the defenseless. And so he makes it very clear his feelings on that. "If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest." And we've got a big problem in our country right now because of the interest-only loans that have gone out. I mean, our whole economic system is on the verge of collapse. The federal government jumping in, what is it, $800 billion that they're looking to rescue this market? Because people in desperation, "I've got to flip a house, you know, I'm going to get an interest-only," and the thing is just crashing. And unfortunately, it's not just bad for them, it's bad for us, because as a society, we pay for it as a whole. In other parts of Scripture, Leviticus, for example, God does allow loans at interest, but God says, don't take advantage of a person that is desperate. The love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, the Bible says. So we have to be very careful. It doesn't mean having money is evil. It doesn't mean not having money is evil. It just says that the love of it, and that can exist at any level. People that are rich can have a love of money, and people that are poor can have a love of money. Unfortunately, it's the rich people who take advantage of the poor people who have a love of money. And when two people go into a situation with a love of money, usually the rich person wins, and the poor person is left just holding a bag of sorrows. And so God says, I don't want any of that. "If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, for that's his only covering. It's his garment for his skin. What then will he sleep in? It will be that when he cries out, I will hear, for I am gracious." So in those days, and of course, in many places in Africa, people would actually sleep. You can go to certain places, you go out at night, and everybody just bundles up. Go to India, and at nighttime, they just bundle up, and they sleep right there. And they get up, and they wrap themselves, and they go. God says, if you take that garment for a pledge, you give it back. Give it back to him at night. Don't make him suffer for his promise. "You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people." Oh, man, I wanted to curse a ruler of our people, you know. You just talk politics, and it's so easy. You just start talking about what's going on today. But God says, I don't want you to do that. I want you to respect the position. Not necessarily the person, but respect the position. Don't curse a ruler of your people. "You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me." We spoke about that before. "Likewise, you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me." It speaks about giving to God. It speaks about the respect that we give to God when we give him our first fruits. "You shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat meat torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs." So no roadkill. You can't eat animals that have been, you know, look, a mongoose has been hit on the road. Let's have a dinner, you know. Look, a possum, you know, it just, nope, you can't do that. Come on. "Be holy men," God says. "You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice." So God's talking about law and order here. You don't go along with mob justice. "You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute." So here's an interesting thing. Look at verse 6 with me. "You shall not pervert the judgment of the poor in his dispute." God says if you're a judge and you're hearing a case from a poor man, don't give him sympathy just because he's poor. He might deserve to be poor. He might have made all the wrong decisions, spent all his money on the wrong things. He might have wasted it away. Don't show extra sympathy because somebody's financial situation. But then in verse 6, "But you also don't crush a person because they're poor." God wants an equal playing field for everybody. Notice verse 4. If you meet an enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. So I think about this verse, you know, here you are, you see, oh, that guy hates me, and I hate him back, and there is his donkey. I don't want to help him. God says, as soon as you think, I don't want to help him. That's what that word would. You would refrain. I don't want to help that guy. As soon as you think that, help him. Do the very opposite. There was a dog walking down the street the other day. I tried to catch him. He wouldn't let me catch him, but that was the right thing to do. I mean, my neighbor's dog is out. I don't know. But there's my neighbor. That guy, he's always making noise late at night, and his car lights are on. It's 8 o'clock at night. I know that battery's going to be dead in the morning. That's going to be great. I'm going to get him. Nope. I go up in the car. I turn his lights off, or I knock on his door. I tell him, hey, your lights are on. As soon as I think I don't want to help that person, that's when you help them. That's a good way to remember. Verse 7, it says, keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. You shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning. Here's a discerning person. Everybody knows they're discerning. This person is so wise. As soon as they take a bribe, they're blind. They're unable to discern. And it perverts the words of the righteous. There's a righteous person. I know they're going to make the right decision. Not after money gets involved. I just heard about one of our former presidents who has made $15.4 million in the past number of years from some company in Yucaipa, California. Just payouts, million here, million there, 100,000 here. Just over the years, and everybody knows it just stinks of corruption. $15.4 million. Sad, but it happens. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce, but the seventh year shall rest and lie fallow, and the poor of your people may eat. So the seventh year, the vineyard, the orchard, the wheat field, you don't plow it, you just let it grow. There's a bunch of stuff going to grow. God says, here it's sort of a beautiful, responsible welfare system. A responsible welfare system where the people that are poor, they can gather. The seventh year, it's their field. Whatever grows, they can get it. And that the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner, you shall do with your vineyard and your olive groves. So not only 6 years and the seventh year of rest, 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female servant and the stranger may be refreshed. So this is even for the lowest people in society. You don't say, oh, it's the seventh day, I'm going to take a day off. All my servants do all the work. That's what they do in Israel today. Everything runs on the seventh day, and the non-Israelis do all the work. And they say, well, we don't spend cash, but we can run our credit cards. You know, they find a way around the law. It's very interesting the way they do that. Our Sabbath is Jesus. So we don't need to respect one day above another. We have rest in Jesus. However, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking I should be preaching this to myself. I should rest on the seventh day. Notice verse 13. And in all that I have said to you, be circumspect. Circumspect. You might have a different word, but when I read the word circumspect, there's two words there. Circum, which means around, circumference. And spect is to see. It's to look around. Be aware. Be cautious. In everything that I'm saying to you, listen to what I'm saying. Understand what I'm saying. In everything that I've said to you, be circumspect and make no mention of the names of the other gods, nor let it be heard in your mouth. Don't even talk about that. Unfortunately, Israel is going to go after these other gods when they get into the land. Now he requires 3 times a year, you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. That's the feast of Passover. You shall eat unleavened bread. They would combine Passover and the 7 days, the feast of unleavened bread, together. And he says, as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt, none shall appear before me empty. And the Feast of Harvest, this would be about 50 days later. This is the Feast of Weeks or Shavuot or what we know as Pentecost, Acts chapter 2. It was Pentecost, the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labor, which you have sown in the field. And then the third feast, the Feast of Ingathering. That's the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Sukkot, when they would just basically camp out for a week. Everybody would go to Jerusalem. It's in about October, so it's not too cold yet. And they would just camp out, and they would look at the stars. Great time. And the Lord required these feasts at the end of the year when you had gathered in the fruit. So the first fruits, the harvest, the wheat and the barley would be at Pentecost, and then the fruit would be at the end of the year. And God would require them to come and offer. He says, none of you come before me empty-handed. I don't want you to come and not offer anything. David said, I will not offer the Lord something that costs me nothing. So God says, when you come, bring something. I want you to bring something when you come. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. Leaven is a type of sin. It would be illogical to offer blood and a type of sin. Nor with the fat of my sacrifice, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. This is an interesting verse. This actually probably speaks about an Egyptian and Canaanite fertility rite. At the end of the harvest, what they would do is they would do this strange thing where they would take a newborn baby, they would milk a goat, and they would boil it in the milk, and then they would scatter it on the fields. And they felt that that would cause fertility, it would cause great growth in the next year. God says, I don't want you doing any of that. Now, the funny thing is that the Jews have taken this, and what religion tends to do a lot of times is it builds on things so much so that it has nothing to do with what God originally intended. And to eat kosher today, according to Israelis, is to not eat milk and meat together. You can't eat dairy and meat together at all. No cheeseburgers, no pepperoni pizza. I mean, oh. And it's all because of this verse. They say, well, you know, the chances are, because if you eat, you know, goat kebab, and then you drink some milk, there's a slight chance that might have the milk of that goat's mother. It's going to go into your stomach. It's going to seethe together. You're boiling the kid in its mother's milk. How do they get that out of this little verse? I like to go over to Genesis 18:8. You don't have to turn there. But that's when Abraham made for God and two angels meat, milk, and butter. And so I'll ask my Jewish friends, how come God himself ate a cheeseburger, if you will? And they don't know because I don't know what they're going to do with that. And this only deals with goats. It doesn't deal with cows. I don't know where chickens get milk. I mean, you can't see the chicken in its mother's milk. I mean, and so, but they do it across the board, except they leave fish out. And they, you know, give or take here or there. God says, behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. In my Bible, angel is capitalized. And here's the reason why. Verse 21, beware of him, obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. For my name is in him. And so angels don't pardon transgressions. Only God does. This is the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord. Or you might just call it a Christophanes. A Christophany is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. You know, the Son of God has been from the very beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so the Son of God, the Bible says that no man has seen God at any time, but the only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father has expressed him or declared him. And so when Moses saw God, or he saw a representation of God, well, he didn't see the Father because God is spirit, Jesus would say. He saw the representation of the Son of God who is the Word. And so it says, my name is in him, the name Yeshua, actually. On my shirt here, it says, Yeshua Malki, Jesus my King. And in that word, Yeshua, is the name Yahweh. My name is in him. Literally, it's very beautiful. That's what the angel would say to Joseph. He says, name him Yeshua, for he will save his people. He will save his people. Yeshua means Jehovah saves. A beautiful example of Jesus being Jehovah. He is Yahweh, because the angel says, name him Jehovah saves, for he will save his people. It's a beautiful picture there. And so he's going to go with them. Later on, Joshua is going to see that angel standing there with a sword, and he's going to say, whose side are you on? going to say, I'm on either side. Get behind me. You're on my side. And take your shoes off. This is holy ground. And that was the picture of Jesus Christ, the commander of the Lord's armies. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, I will be an enemy to your enemies. Well, that's what you want, don't you? If you have an enemy, well, God can be your enemy and an adversary to your adversaries. My angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. And you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. Unfortunately, Israel would do this very thing. They would bow down to them in their future. So you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water. And I will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. So God promised them supernatural health and blessing. He says, I will send my fear before you, and I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. Have you ever been stung by a hornet? Anybody been stung by a hornet? A wasp? A hornet? You know, there's these Asian hornets that are about the size of your thumb. Hold your thumb up if you're a man. And there's these hornets that are 2.5 inches long. They've got a wingspan of 3 inches. And hornets are not like bees. They can sting over and over and over again. These things are gnarly. And I actually looked it up, and it says that they secrete the highest percentage, 5% of their sting is acetylcholine, which is actually, it multiplies pain. It's a neurotransmitter. And God has made these little devils so powerful that if you, and they actually secrete pheromones. If you smack one near a hive, the whole hive will mobilize and they'll just come out, you know, butts facing forward. They're flying, just stinging the whole way, and they'll sting and they can kill you. And so no matter if you were a giant or you were tiny, doesn't matter. These Canaanites, these giants in the land, it didn't matter. God says, you know what? I'm going to send. And those people knew what hornets could do. And you couldn't slap it because, you know, then the other hornets would come after you. So you just run. And that's what God says. They're going to turn their backs and they're out of here. And so God is going to promise. And that's a great thing. You know, when God leads us into the land, he promises, man, he doesn't say there aren't going to be big giants. There aren't going to be obstacles. There aren't going to be difficulties. But he says, I'm going to be supernaturally on your side. I'm going to give you wisdom that you don't even expect. And you're going to have an army of hornets going out. Could you imagine that? Let's march out to battle. And then 1,000, here they come. Just hornets going out before. You don't even have to fight. They just, you know, the enemies are just running. What are they running from? You see those little things, you know, 2.5 inches, the big stingers. Just over and over. God just amazingly. And God promises that he's going to do that. But he says, I'm not going to drive them out, verse 29, from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I'm not going to wipe them all out. Then it'll be overpopulated with lions. He says, I'm going to drive them out little by little, verse 30, from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. So God wants them to grow into their blessings. This is a lesson for you and I. Sometimes I wish God would just wipe out all my enemies. All my personality problems. Now, you probably don't think I have any, but all my introversion, my depression, my sins, my attitude problems. I wish you'd just wipe them all out. But God just says, you know, I'm going to drive it out slowly so that in the process you can fill that place so that you can grow. Sometimes we wish God would just take care of everything, but God doesn't work like that. He wants you to grow into the blessings. He wants you to increase and grow in your size. And he provides you the stress that you need as a process of growing you into that. You know, it's not what we would like, but that's just the way that God works. God allows enemies to tend and till the land until they move in and occupy it. And so he says, I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the sea, Philistia, and from the desert to the river. Now that speaks of the river Euphrates. And so if you want to know what the real boundaries of Israel are, don't look to CNN, but look to Exodus chapter 23. God says it's the whole thing. And they're fighting over this little area, West Bank, Gaza, just a tiny area. Imagine if they tried to reclaim what God said was there. Oh, man, it would be World War IV. And so he says, I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will be a snare to you. Now he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Now Moses goes back. The people are all there at the mountain. The mountain's filled with smoke. And God says, I want you to bring up some of the elders. And Moses alone shall come up near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him. So Moses came and told the people all the words. Now all these things, Moses came. This is what God said. Here it is. Genesis 20, 10 commandments, and then all these details. And he tells them all the words. Verse 3 says, and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice. All the people, one voice. Here they are, unified, in unison. All the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. So Moses wrote all the words down. It's not just good enough to say it. He's going to write it down. And he rose early in the morning. He built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and he put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant. Remember, he wrote it down. And he read it in the hearing of the people. He read it a second time. And all the people said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. 6 weeks later, they're going to be worshiping a golden cow. But they were so sure, so confident that they were going to do it all. But it's amazing how the Lord knows that, well, as soon as you make a commitment, you need to apply blood to that situation because they're going to fail. And so he takes the blood and he sprinkles the book. Notice what it says in verse 7. He took the book of the covenant. He read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. And so Moses took the blood. He sprinkled it on the people. And he says, this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to these words. Now you are bound to this. I'm so grateful that I'm not sprinkled with the blood of an ox, but with the blood of a lamb of God, Jesus Christ. We have a different covenant, the covenant of Jesus. He was slain, I'm sprinkled. I have a new covenant. And Moses took the blood, he sprinkled it on the people and said, this is the blood of the covenant. Verse 9, now Moses went up, also Aaron and his sons Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, so representations. And it says, and they saw the God of Israel. This is the only time in the history of Israel that they would have a revelation like this. They saw the God of Israel. John chapter 1:18 says, no man has seen God. But Jesus would later say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus is everything that we need to know about God. If you want to know what God is like, just look at Jesus. So they saw the God of Israel, and it was probably Jesus. And they couldn't even describe him. What they describe is what was under his feet. It says there was under his feet a paved work as of sapphire stone. It was like the very heavens in its clarity. Over in Revelation, we read that under the throne is the sea of glass. Maybe it's something like that. I almost picture there they see God, and all they can do is lower their head. Well, what did you see? Well, there was something under him. I remember seeing what he was on. I couldn't look. You know, the glory of God was just so awesome. But the nobles of the children of Israel did not lay his hand, so he didn't strike them. And they saw God and they ate and drank. There's something about God and eating. He says, three times you got to come and eat before me. He just wants us to eat. You know, praise the Lord for that. Every time Jesus appeared after his resurrection, he shows up and he says, you guys got any food? You know, and then they're fishing they come to the shore and he's got breakfast made. Every time. He's always eating. I mean, he's eating dinner. He says, do this in remembrance of me. Remember me by eating. Let's get some pizzas. Order them in. Bring them here. We'll close the night. Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone. That is, it never changes. There are no revised statutes. When I was in the government, we had the HRS, Hawaii Revised Statutes. 17 volumes of them, just giant, because they keep changing them. God says, you know what, I'm going to write it one time, put it in stone, never change it. There are no revised statutes. There's just one law, write it in stone. Write it in pen, not even erasable. And the law that I've commanded you, which I have written, that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant, Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So there are the elders, the 70, they're about halfway up. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. This means disaster. Of course, we know what happens. They come to Aaron just a few weeks later and say, hey, we don't know where this Moses is. Why don't you make us a god? He says, all right, I'll make you a god. Let's make a god. And that whole thing we've covered before. But Moses went up into the mountain. A cloud covered the mountaintop, and the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai. And the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. They must have been pretty impressed because God had said, nobody can even come close to the mountain. If you even get close, kill them. If an ox wanders in, stone it. Don't shoot it with arrows. Just stay away. But then God brings the elders close, and they eat, and they see God. And then Moses and Joshua go up a little further, and then just Moses enters in, and they see from a distance just this cloud. It looks like a burning fire, just glowing, shimmering, just bright burning. There's smoke coming up, and Moses, nobody could live in that. But Moses does, and the people saw it. It was pretty awesome. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud. He went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights.